This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 22, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast. There are over 200 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. And this is the free version of the episode. The extended episode is 16 minutes longer than this version. And to get access to the extra 16 minutes, you can join the Alien UFO Podcast Patreon campaign. And when you sign up for $7.50 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $4.50 a month, you get an extended episode every month. There are now 22 extended episodes available. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You become a patron by going to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and the links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. So this week I'm talking to Philip Mantle about his new book, UFO Landings UK. Philip Mantle is an international UFO researcher, lecturer, and broadcaster. His books have been published in 6 different languages around the world. He is the former Director of Investigations for the British UFO Research Association and former MUFON representative for England. Philip has written articles and features for numerous publications around the world and has been both editor and assistant editor of High Street UFO Publications, and he is the founder of Flying Disc Press. Hi, Philip. Thanks for coming back to the podcast.
Good morning, Simon. My pleasure.
So I wanted to talk to you about your new book. It's called UFO Landings UK. It's such a comprehensive book. There are so many cases in there. It's so fascinating to read. How did it come together? Well, it's not something we usually hear about, UFO landings in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, Simon. I mean, going way back in time, the first UFO landing case that I ever investigated personally goes back to the 1980s, and summer of 1980, with a colleague of mine who used to be Matt Purcell at the Yorkshire UFO Society, no doubt. I hadn't been involved in the subject that long, and I did some local press, and a lady rang us and she said, Philip, you know, you won't believe us, so give us a chance, you know. Anyway, I for those who are not aware, I live in the north of England, in West Yorkshire, and at that point in time, I lived just outside of Leeds, just a few miles from Wakefield, and this lady was phoning from a town called Normanton, which is literally just up the road from where we live, a few miles up the motorway. So we went to see her. She was called Mrs. Westerman. And what she told us was, you know, the children had been playing out. She lived in a terraced house, and it was a cul-de-sac. There was no houses facing her. And she lived in an elevated house, so you had to go up 5 or 6 steps to get in the front door. It was just after lunch, a lovely summer's day, the children were outside playing a ball game. She was washing the dishes. And one of the children came running in the house and said, Mum, there's an aeroplane crashed in the field. So at the bottom of this cul-de-sac was some trees, a little stream, and then on a hill, there was a field with some electricity pylons on it. So she came out of the front door, and because it was an elevated house, she could see across these fields. And she said, Philip, it wasn't an aeroplane. It was something shaped like a Mexican hat. Or she also described it as like a tank, but with no gun turret on it, but with rounded edges. It was like a silver grey colour. So she got the children, walked down to the bottom of the cul-de-sac through the trees. You go down a small dip and you lose sight of the hills. So you come up the other side, and there's a fence bordering this field. And this thing was still there, but now there were 3 tall humanoid creatures, all dressed in a white boiler suit of some description, a big boots on. They had mittens on their hands, no gloves. They had a visor over their face. and they seemed to be waving something across the ground. One of the children actually tried to climb the fence, but Mrs. Westerman held him back. And at which point these three men walked to the back of this thing. It rose up into a clear blue sky, stopped in midair, and then shot off whence it had came without making a sound. I mean, to say she was flabbergasted is to say the least. We interviewed her. We interviewed all the children. They didn't call it a spaceship or aliens. They just said this thing. And Mark and I even interviewed one of their friends, one of the children's friends. He'd actually gone home for his lunch and he'd missed all the excitement. So, you know, he told us when he came back, they were all excited talking about this and so on. So, you know, like I said, Simon, I hadn't been involved in the subject that long. And if I had any doubts that, you know, there was a phenomena here worthy of my time and investigation, this confirmed it for us. Because most of the UFO books that were available, and there weren't a lot you could get your hands on in those days, talked about things overseas, you know, far away, Roswell, I mean, you name it. But this was in my own back garden, literally just a few miles up the road. And that's what started it. I mean, down the decades since then, I've been involved with just about every type of UFO event you can imagine. But I always had a biased feeling for the UFO landing cases. So I went back to what the late Dr. Hynek said, and he talked about high strangeness cases. So in other words, the closer you get to these things, the more people that are involved, you know, the more witnesses that are involved, if there's any documentation, any physical damage to the environment, et cetera, it keeps building up the layers of high strangeness. And that leads you to the probability that you're dealing with the genuine article, whatever that may be. And it's less likely to be misidentified. And what puzzled Mrs. Westerman, almost as much as seeing the thing itself, Simon, was Normanton was a busy little town. It was a mining town in that era. All the mines have gone now, of course. It was a beautiful day, so people were out and about. The M62 motorway, one of the busiest motorways in the north of England, goes right past it, but yet no one else seems to have come forward. She sat down that evening to watch the local news. As, you know, she was sure that there were going to be a news item about it. Nothing. She bought the local newspaper, nothing. She even asked a few of her neighbours, and again, absolutely nothing. So you're left with two conclusions, really. One is they were all lying. Two is they were telling the truth. And I could find no reason why they would lie. Mrs. Westerman wouldn't allow us to take a photograph. When we originally wrote the account up, we weren't allowed to use her real name. She didn't want any publicity. Her husband worked down the coal mine. I was born and bred in a coal mining community. My father worked down the coal mines all his life. The children, the ball game they were playing, it's a made-up game, and it's the same thing that I used to play when I was their age. So I knew these kind of people, Simon. I'd grown up with them. And so that really was, you know, sowing the seed for what later would become the book UFO Landings UK. Obviously, there was no book in mind at that time, but what I did down the years is slowly but surely build a file of just UFO landing cases, slowly but surely. And the book idea has probably been on the back burner for, I don't know, at least 10 years, if not longer. So when the COVID-19 lockdown came along, I thought that was the perfect time to finish it. I mean, I hadn't even started it, so I don't about finish it. So if anyone goes on Amazon to buy the book, they may see that the publication date is registered as 2020. That was when I first uploaded the cover. And once you upload something, it sets that as the date, but it has only literally just come out. So it's not been hanging around for 2 years. I just wait. We're actually making hopefully a documentary about it based on the book. But that was, you know, all put on hold because of COVID. And I felt, you know, come this year, the COVID pandemic has kind of dissipated, and all the lockups have gone. So I thought it was the best time to release the book, and it's up and running, mate. And you know, that's how it all came about, Simon. Really, had it not been for the COVID lockdown, it might have still been gathering dust in my filing cabinet. So there you go.
Going back to the Westerman case, did you contact one of the children recently, and the lady still had the same story?
Well, what happened was, again, I did a podcast a couple of years back, and for whatever reason, I forgot to mention the lady's name. It wasn't done on purpose. It's just one of those things. A couple of weeks after this, I was contacted by a lady from New Zealand. She told me she was originally from the UK and immigrated to New Zealand. And in fact, she was from Normanton. And she wanted to know the lady's name, so I told her. And she said her best friend when she lived in Normanton was called Westerman. And she was still in touch with her. So she changed her name now because she'd got married. So she got in touch with her. And lo and behold, her best friend was one of these children that I interviewed all those years ago, one of Mrs. Westerman's siblings. And I contacted her via email, and she confirmed all the main points of the story. We were trying to organise a time to meet up. She'd got her own family, and then COVID hit. And so there was no meetings allowed, of course. So I left it, but she did confirm it all, and that confirmation was put into the book, and I was very grateful for that. So, you know, I've run this story in our local press here a couple of times down the years, just to see if anyone else might step forward, and so far no one has. So. You know, we have to say at the moment we're not aware of any other witnesses. It was nice to get back in touch with one of the children, you know, and have it confirmed yet again all these years later. And again, she didn't want any publicity. In fact, you know, that was the last thing on her mind. She'd got her own family now. She's got a young family. But that started the ball rolling in as far as my interest in UFO landing cases in the UK began, Simon. So a fascinating case, and it's not one you'll read about anywhere else. But nonetheless, I find it absolutely fascinating. While we were there, for example, my colleague, Mark Birdsall, Mark was quite a good artist. So as Mrs. Westerman is talking, he's got his notebook out and his pencil, and she thought he was taking notes. It was me that was taking notes. Mark was actually drawing what, you know, and he said to her, "Did it look like that?" She says, "Oh, yeah, that's pretty close." So, yeah, very interesting case indeed. And like I said, it's not one you'll hear about anywhere else.
And the cases you got cover quite a lot of decades. Where did you get them all from? Because I can't be just yourself doing all this investigation.
The book itself is split into decades, so we go from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and so on, just as a way of configuring how to lay out the book. But there are a number of the cases in there where I did interview the witnesses myself in person, because when I began my involvement in this subject, Simon, there wasn't much else you could do. Very few books you could lay your hands on, no newsstand magazines, but lots of local groups. So what I did, again, down the years, I've, you know, because of my involvement, I've been part of Bufora, I've been a magazine editor. I got to know a lot of people, had a lot of contacts. And if I saw something of interest, I would say, oh, by the way, can you let me have a copy of that? And that could have been an article they wrote about a case, or even someone I would go along and interview myself. So the files on UFO landing cases built up as the years progressed. And sometimes, even though someone else may have been the original investigator, if I had the opportunity to go and interview the person in question myself, I would do exactly that. It's a lot easier now, Simon, because we have all this modern technology, and you and I speaking across the internet today. So, you know, things are easier today. So, you know, I collected magazine articles, newspaper cuttings, you name it. And one of the biggest places to go is my friend John Hansen. John was a former police detective in the West Midlands Police Force, the CID, now retired. But John has been rescuing UFO reports, files, ephemera, books, magazines for many years now. He publishes his own books under the Haunted Skies banner. And he's got the biggest archive of UFO material anywhere in the UK, as far as I'm aware. So whenever I was looking for something, John was usually my first port of call to see what he had. And he's been of tremendous assistance in either supplying information or putting me in touch with people. So, and we've worked, you know, I've done the same for him on occasion as well. So it's good that you have, you know, colleagues in the UK that will assist you when you're working on a research topic or writing a book or whatever. And of course, as we know now, Simon, we can digitize a lot of things. So I don't have to go and buy tons and tons of magazines. A lot of them are already digitized, and people can share the, either the whole magazine or an article or an interview with someone. But if I got the opportunity, certainly in the early days, it was in the car, throw my kit bag in the boot, Simon, and I would be off and I would interview these people. And, you know, I still like to do that when I can.
And the earliest one you have in the book is 1767, which is quite interesting. The language they use as well is quite old-fashioned, but it almost describes as something that turned into a pyramid shape when it started moving.
Yeah, well, I guarantee you I didn't go back to interview anybody from this, but it's an extract from what was called the British Magazine. And it's 1767, page 500. And it was Saturday, September the 12th. And it's an extract from a letter from Edinburgh. You know, somebody had written in. And I'll read it out. It's only a small paragraph. I'll read it out. It says, "We hear from Perthshire that an uncommon phenomenon was observed on the water of Isla near Copper Angus, preceded by a thick, dark smoke, which soon dispelled and discovered a large, luminous body like a house on fire, but presently after took the form of something pyramidal and rode forwards with impetuosity till it came to the water of Erik, up which river it took its direction with great rapidity and disappeared a little above Blairgowrie. The effects were as extraordinary as the appearance. In its passage, it carried a large cart many yards over a field of grass. A man riding along the high road was carried from his horse and so stunned with a fall as to remain senseless for a considerable time. It destroyed one half of a house and left the other behind undermined, and destroyed an arch on the new bridge building at Blairgowrie, immediately after which it disappeared. As few appearances of this kind ever were attended with like consequences, various conjectures have been formed concerning it." In other words, various conjectures. They didn't know what it was, and they're tossing their theories into the hat. And it is, you know, it's a fascinating little account. I mean, throughout the book, Simon, and even when we reach the end, and I don't come to any definitive conclusions. I leave that to the readers. And one of the things we do at the end of the book is ask my colleagues, again, just in the UK and the UK only, for what are their conclusions, or do they have any conclusions about the phenomena? And here we have a sighting going back to 1767, pretty much saying the same thing. We don't know what it is. There's various conjectures. But yes, pyramid shape. What do we get a lot of, or have we had a lot of, is, you know, flying triangles. So if that were reported today, it may well be reported as a UFO encounter. Would you not agree?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And one of the things I noticed over time as going through the decades is that the UFO technology seemed to advance as we did. And it's almost like there's science fiction from these eras, and the craft would almost be like that. It's almost like the craft we see is more advanced than our technology, but not so advanced we just do not understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So our technology is advanced, and so the UFOs people see today are more advanced than they were 60 years ago. But it's weird to me. It's almost like the ETs are doing it on purpose. They're showing us something so that we can understand it. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, the phenomena, whatever it may or may not be, has, to want of a better phrase, evolved. Because we start with these simple sightings, and like you said, it changes as the decades go. Everybody talks about is these flaming Tic Tacs, because of the Navy videos, the US Navy videos that were released, and subsequent testimony to accompany them, of course. And they call it a Tic Tac. It looks like Tic Tac Sweetie, you know, the little things in the box. But yes. You know, things have developed as the years go by. It's one of the reasons why I stuck to putting it in decades. You know, I thought, well, maybe should I put it as, you know, geographic locations, do one county at a time or one country at a time, maybe just have it in four parts, you know, England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales. But no, I thought it makes more sense to do it, you know, decade by decade. And then you can see for yourself how things have changed down the years. I mean, literally, just over the page from that one that we've just read out from 1767, there's a chap called Mr. T.W. This is 1908. And he first wrote in when he was 85 years of age. But it goes back in time to when he was 10. And there's a drawing of the UFO, and it looks like a house, you know, with a little door and a thing on the top, and it's got an electrical current going around it. So it's, you know, Simon, a couple of years back again, I was being interviewed by someone, and they said a similar type of thing to me. They said, where have all the Space Brothers gone? Because, of course, back in the 1950s, you know, the subject wasn't that old, and it wasn't the little bug-eyed grey aliens that we've seen. It was the beautiful blonde Space Brothers reported by the contactee movement. And, of course, you don't get that anymore, or by and large, you don't anyway. So it was a good question. Where have all the Space Brothers gone? And you can ask the same question here, or a similar type of question. The encounters in themselves have evolved down the years. Why that is, your guess is as good as mine, but the book does illustrate that.
And it's like you say, the ETs change over time as well, and they're different sizes and wearing different clothing, and it's almost as if there's so many different civilizations out there that were visiting Earth, but at the same time, that seems a bit far-fetched.
It does. You know, I've always said, you know, The phenomena itself is real, but it's just how we perceive it. And when I say we, I mean we as a species and we as individuals. And if you look at the phenomenon around the world, it is perceived differently. There are cultural influences on how these things are perceived. And that's not just with this phenomenon, it's with a whole range. But give you an idea of again, a slight difference, but it goes back to 1943, the middle of the Second World War. Again, I had the opportunity to interview this gentleman. He was called John Warren. It was May 1943. Mr. Warren was at a place called RAF Ludham in Norwich, in Norfolk. He was an armourer, so he would fit the, you know, the incendiaries and the bombs and the bullets to the aircraft at RAF Ludham. And he'd been to a dance at a local village. And unfortunately for him, he missed the last train back. So he had a 12-mile walk in front of him. Now, the only thing he was worried about at that time was getting back late, because you didn't want to get back late because you get into trouble. So he walks the 12 miles home. He's approaching the town and the base. And up ahead, by the side of the grass verge, he sees this green glow. As he gets nearer, there is a humanoid figure standing by the side of the road. And this figure has a box on its chest, and it's shining a green light up into its face, making it look like it's got some kind of stupid grin on its face, you know, and it stands there perfectly still. Behind this on the grass verge is an object on the ground. Mr. Warren said it was shaped like a bell tent and was illuminated. And then to the left of that, again, and behind this figure are two more figures. And it frightened the living daylights out of him. He ran back to the barracks. Luckily for him, he had a friend waiting up for him and let him in through a window, so he wasn't going to get in any trouble in that respect. But he was very scared. And although you won't find it in the book, I interviewed Mr. Warren in the 80s, so, you know, 40 years after this event, and it still stuck in his mind. And he said to me, "Philip, you know, I don't write this." He said, "But if it had been armed that night, I would have shot this thing, because this is 1943. You know, it's the height probably of the Second World War at that point." He said, I just knew it wasn't one of us, so it's not one of us. It must be one of them. One of them being the enemy, of course." And he said, "I was shot it." And it kind of reminded me, if we spring forward in time, with Police Constable Alan Godfrey in Todmorden in late 1980. He encountered an object in his patrol car one morning going through Todmorden. It's a long story, but we won't go into it all. But one of the things that Alan said, he said, if it had a brick, he could have thrown it at it and it would have gone clunk. Not quite as severe as John Warren was thinking about back during war days, but, you know, a similar type of thing, really. And Mr. Warren could clearly remember this incident, Simon. You know, it stuck with him all these years. He'd reported it to Buforan in the 1960s. He reported it to me again because he'd seen me in the local media. And I only lived nearby, so I took the opportunity to go along and speak to him in person. And it, you know, it's a fascinating little incident that again, won't appear anywhere else apart from in my book, I wouldn't imagine. I just give you an idea of some of the other things that were going on.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about a case that is described as near London in 1937, where a woman was carried on board an object. And some of it seemed like modern day abduction reports, where she says she realised she was unable to move. And that's what people report, don't they? In abductions in the 90s and 2000s.
Yeah. I'll read that section out. It says, an 8-year-old girl was walking along in a meadow when she saw a huge silvery object with slit-like protrusions hovering above her. A platform of some kind descended from the object, and three tall men dressed in red stepped down. One carried her on board the object, and she realized she was unable to move. The interior of the object appeared much larger, and she recalled being placed on a molded chair facing a dazzling bright light. She then experienced unique thoughts and visions. Later, she was taken to an enormous pyramid, just heard that, and wandered inside dark corridors until she found a door that opened to the meadow where she was originally taken from. And yeah, we would absolutely 100% class that as an abduction account today. Although dressed in red is slightly different, of course, and making her own way out is probably slightly different. But what interests me from that account is a number of things. Is she talks about sitting in a molded chair. Now, my first book, which I did a revised edition a couple of years back, is a book called Without Consent. And it's all about abduction cases from the UK. There's a lady in there called Jane Morrison. And I interviewed Jane about her abduction. And she claims that when she was taken on board the UFO, she was put into a molded bath that kind of almost fit her as if it was made for her, you know, made to measure. So that kind of, when I read that about this molded, although it is a molded seat and James was a molded bath, it kind of popped into my head. And then she experienced unique thoughts and visions. Now, again, it's not uncommon, Simon, that when you've spoken to a number of abductees, that they were either shown something, i.e. on a viewing screen of some description, or something was shown inside their head. Prime example is a gentleman who I've done a lot of work with in recent years, is Calvin Parker. Had an encounter on October the 11th, 1973, Pascagoula, Mississippi. And one of the things, just it's a long story, but one of the things, when he was on board, Calvin was shown a mirror. And in that mirror, he says, I was shown terrible things. Things from the past, things from the present, and things from the future. You know, and that kind of rings a bell when you read that she then experienced unique thoughts and visions. So, but of course, this is from 1937. So there's no way she could be reading about Calvin Parker. This happened many, many decades later. So yes, you would class that as an abduction account. What it does, Simon, again, it shows that these things were being reported, albeit briefly, long before Betty and Barney Hill, long before Kenneth Arnold. And these are just a couple of those accounts.
And did you have any accounts that were you were sort of on the fence with? You think maybe this is just too strange. I'm not sure I should put this in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about trying to work out a system of high strangeness, you know, give it a categorization, you know, 1 to 10, how strange is this on the strangeometer, if you like. But I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't figure out, you know, how is one stranger than another? And there are a number of cases that at the end of the day, I thought, no, I'm going to put in because I want to leave the reader to come to their own conclusion, not just me, you know, and I didn't want to be accused of any kind of censorship, if you like. And so when I was going through it, I'm thinking, this is seriously weird because, you know, some of these files have been lingering there for decades. And it's just not possible for me to remember them all off the top of my head. One little thing is an example that involved a chap called John Flaxton and Mervyn Hutchinson and two others. And this was November the 16th, 1963 in Kent, a place called Sandling Park. And they saw this object descending into the woods at Sandling Park. And it was astonishing shite. They were only teenagers. And while they were sort of coming to terms with what they'd seen, something else would soon grab their attention. I'll read this again. Moments after the extraordinary craft apparently landed behind the trees, the teens noticed a shaking in the bush. And what emerged was one of the most unique creatures ever to be chronicled in ufology. Now, it says, later the four horrified eyewitnesses will explain that an erratic, shambling, quasi-humanoid figure emerged from the woods and waddled towards them. The beast apparently looked like a headless bat, but was approximately 5 feet tall, with large webbed feet and wings protruding from its back. In Hutchinson's own words, it didn't seem to have any head. There were huge wings on its back, like bat wings. The group of friends, understandably overwhelmed with terror and adrenaline, sprinted away from this freakish bat thing and made their way to the nearest police station. Once they had related their tale to what was, we assume, a highly skeptical officers. Now, this is, you know, some people have chronicled this as the British Mothman. We have an artist's impression in the book of what this thing supposedly looked like. But it is very bizarre, not so much as what happened, but the encounter with this being. I'm not aware of anywhere else in the UK or even perhaps some other parts of the world where this type of thing has been reported. But I think it's best that I present the information that we have. And like I say, allow the readers to make their own judgment on what it may or may not have been, Simon. But it is very bizarre. As if the sighting wasn't puzzling enough, then this thing come waddling towards you. It's understandable that they would be scared.
And one of the things you mentioned there was the picture in the book, and that's one of the things I like about the book is all the photos and the drawings and the pictures. It really helps sort of bring the cases to life in a way.
Yeah. I've used the original, you know, artwork or scribbles or drawings of maps, but, you know, there's a few artist impressions in there as well.
I wanted to talk to you about the Earl Mountbatten case. And just for the listeners who don't know, Earl Mountbatten was Prince Philip's uncle. He served as the Supreme Allied Commander in Southeast Asia during World War II. And one of the people that worked for him on his estate had a sighting. And Mountbatten said to him, "We know about these things and we're very interested in them," which was a fascinating thing to hear from somebody of that background.
Well, it was his gardener. It was Mountbatten's gardener. Or he may have had a different title than that, but it was his gardener. What we have in the book as well, of course, is the drawing done by the gentleman in question. And it's, you know, the account that we have is largely based on the letters that the gardener himself wrote, you know. And was it Frederick Briggs? Yeah. And Mountbatten's estate was called Broadlands, and it was in Hampshire. And of course, sadly, many years later, Mountbatten was the victim of a terrorist attack that ended his life. But it was February the 25th, 1955. I mean, Briggs was a retired sergeant in the British Army and was working. He said he calls him a maintenance man at Broadlands, the home of Mountbatten. He said he was either riding or wheeling his bicycle, and he said he saw a large craft that looked like a child's top walk hovering over a field. He saw a column descend from the middle of the object with what appeared to be a small 5'6" fair-haired humanoid wearing overalls and a helmet. On reaching close to ground level, the humanoid noticed Briggs observing his descent. Briggs was paralyzed by a strange light beam whilst the humanoid retreated back into the craft. As he arrived at the house, Mountbatten's chauffeur noticed Briggs looked noticeably shocked. And being a good friend, confided his amazing story to the chauffeur, who concluded, you better tell the boss. And after some deliberation, Briggs relented and met with his employer. Mountbatten produced a number of UFO photographs and asked Briggs if he could identify the craft he'd seen. Briggs recalls the Earl saying to him, we know about things and are very interested in them. And there is, you know, there's part of Frederick Briggs's handwritten statement in the book. But it's what is interesting is we do know that the late Prince Philip had a long-standing interest in the UFO subject, and could it have all began with this sighting at Broadlands with one of his family members, one of the in-laws, so to speak? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, Prince Philip used to subscribe to the Flying Saucer Review at one point, and it was common knowledge that he had an interest in the topic, although he's never spoken publicly about it. But here you have, you know, this is on a royal estate, and, you know, there's the whole of Briggs's written statement is in there, plus a drawing of the UFO seen by Briggs and the beam of light and the little creature at the bottom of it. So even the royal family were not out of these sightings, even though it wasn't them directly, but it was on their land at Broadlands. It's a well-known story in UFO circles, but maybe our colleagues overseas may not be aware of it, Simon. So that's another reason for putting that in there.
So is there a case in the book where you look at it and you think, oh boy, I wish I'd been there? Is there one that stands out like that?
Well, there's a lot, really. Certainly the first one I named at Normanton, because it's just up the road from where I live. You know, it's in an area that I'm familiar with. It was the kind of people that I was very familiar with. I was born and bred in a mining community. Like I said, my father worked down the mines all his life. And I even visited the mines on a school excursion from high school. It was a recruiting campaign. There's no way they were going to get me working down there. But you know, I'll tell you of one encounter that's not in the book, because it came my way after the book was completed. And I did a bit of TV last year, and one of the programs I made was shown. And a local chap around here, Simon, sent me an email. And he says, I've got something from my wife's great-grandfather I'd like to show you. And, or grandfather, I can't remember which now. And he's going to come along and have a chat. So, you know, once COVID lockdown allowed, this gentleman came along. And what it was, his wife's grandfather, he'd been a mining engineer. You know, he designed lift shafts and all this kind of thing. And before he passed away, he self-wrote his own memoirs. They weren't very extensive, Simon. This is not some huge volume of work. But he typed it out and he printed, you know, 8 or 10 copies out just for his family. And of course, this chap said the first half of the memoirs are about how he grew up and where he grew up. He actually grew up near Manchester. And then the second half is about his career as a mining engineer. He said, but when you go to the first half, there is the largest chapter in the whole memoir is simply called The Encounter. And it's about this gentleman going back to 1911. Again, he lived up near Manchester. Him and his friend had set off one morning to go to the park. He had to walk a fair way to get to it. And they came through on this clearing, and he said there was this cigar-shaped thing on the ground. And they approached it, a door opened, these humanoids appeared, but they looked almost like you and I, Simon, but they were think they described them as either Asian looking or Oriental. They had coloured clothing on. They even wore a small turban on their heads. And they took them on board, you know, conversed with them, and then sent them on their way. Again, I'm cutting a long story short. And I thought about, you know, repaginating the book and putting that in there, but I thought, no, it's too much work, I'll leave it. But this is an encounter that was only known about by a handful of people, and that handful of people were this gentleman's family. You know, this wasn't a memoirs that were published anywhere, Simon. They were just, you know, for his own family use. And it makes you wonder how many more things like this are still lying around in somebody's filing cabinet or in the garage or in the, you know, in the attic somewhere. But like you said, like you mentioned yourself, these were almost like the Space Brother. Look, they were a precursor to the Space Brothers because they weren't blue-eyed, blonde-haired. And a very bizarre tale, a very bizarre. And you know, but it's the biggest chapter in the whole of the memoir. So it obviously had an influence on him. It obviously struck home, whatever this experience was. And looking back, maybe I should have, you know, rework the book and put it in there. But if I ever do a revised version, that'll be one for it. But, you know, you'd love to be hanging around there when something like that happened, you know. But it's a long time ago, but it'll just give you an example. Another case that's in the book goes to the summer of the 1980s. And I thought for a long time this was just a story. The British pop group Hot Chocolate, who were very successful in the late 70s and 1980s, they released a song called No Doubt About It. And it's about a flying saucer landing. You know, it lands right there in front of you, no doubt about it. The lead singer was Errol Brown. And I think it made it to number two in the UK, but it was their biggest seller around the world. And I just thought, this is just a pop song, you know, like most pop songs, somebody just sits down and makes them up. However, it's not. It's actually about a real-life UFO landing case. Now, none of the band members of Hot Chocolate observed this thing. It was actually the writers of the song, and one of whom is Steve Glenn. Steve Glenn still lives, still works in the business, lives down near London. So I managed to get hold of Steve and interview him on the telephone. And he said the event in question was real. He said they were driving to their recording studio one night, him and his writing partner. Behind them in a van, they had another pop group. It wasn't Hot Chocolate. I think they were called The Toys. And they were going to do some recording. He says when this thing descended out of the sky, he described it as a large orange thing. And it landed. They got out of their vehicles. And this UFO started firing these small discs out. So they literally ducked behind a hedge and still continued to observe it. And off it went. They then phoned the police, who much to their surprise, came to the location, but, you know, it was gone by now. And so they went home that night, him and his writing partner, and they wrote that song in 10 minutes. So it was the quickest song he had ever written. Hot Chocolate recorded it, and it became a massive hit around the world. You know, a massive hit. But like I say, I always thought it was just a made-up song, just a pop song. But in fact, it is based on a real-life UFO landing case here in the UK. And, there are, you know, the details are all in the book. Now, that would have been a sight to have seen, Simon, surely, because you've got two men in one car, four or five band members in the back. They said there was traffic going by as well. So, yeah, fascinating stuff.
Would you say the cases in this book are just typical of cases in every country worldwide? There's nothing unique about the UK?
No, I wouldn't. I would say that there is things that are unique in the UK. Not so much the parameters that make up these experiences, but some of the things that are seen within it. I did mention that in my opinion, there's a cultural influence now we perceive these events. And if you look at the bat creature, that is very bizarre. There's another incident that took place in Wales at a place I can't pronounce, but it's called Machynlleth. That's the best way I can. And this happened on July the 22nd, 1975. And it's a young chap called Trevor and his dad head to the beach. And behind the beach is some rocks. So, you know, Trevor, being a youngster, climbs up the rocks. And lo and behold, he sees this object on the ground. It's circular. It's got lights going around it, coloured lights. It's a dome-shaped object. But what is the most peculiar thing about it, Simon, is what's in it. You can see into this dome, and there are two outlines of figures that I can only describe as being like jelly men, like jelly figures. They're almost like molten. So with inside these figures, it was all churning and moving. And Trevor ran down the rocks, shouted at his dad, you know, there's a flying saucer or whatever, and run back up. And his dad thought, what's he talking about? And he could see up the rocks, he could see Trevor hiding behind a rock, and his head was bobbing up and down because Trevor was hiding behind a rock trying to keep an eye on these things. And again, I don't think anywhere in the world you will ever find a description of these strange forms that were inside this thing. So it is that kind of aspect of these accounts that is very different. And the only sort of well-known case I've really used in the book is Robert Taylor from Livingston in Scotland. And his account happened in November 1979. And Robert was a forestry worker in Decmont Woods, set off to work that morning in his truck and his dog, parked the truck up, walking down the track into the woods, came across a clearing, little clearing in the woods. And in that, sat there on the ground, is this dome-shaped object. He said it had a flange around it with these like little propeller blades sticking up from it. And then at some point, these two round balls with spikes on, he described looking like the Second World War sea mines, although not as big as that, but they either came from underneath it or from behind it. And this was November, so it was muddy. And he said he could hear them plopping along the ground as they came towards him. They got up to to the side of him, he felt some tugging on his trousers and he passed out. When he came around, he could smell a strong smell of sulfur, his dog's doing acrobatics, and this thing has gone. He tries to restart his truck, but he can't drive it. He staggers down home, disheveled and dirty, and his wife said, whatever's happened? And he said, I've been attacked. So she phones the police. And because Mr. Taylor was such an upstanding member of the community, there was obviously something had happened to him. They went to the scene, and there, just in that one location, they found these like caterpillar tracks and other sort of U-shaped indentations in the grass. And they conducted a full forensic police investigation. Fortunately, that night, it was winter, the ground froze, so it protected these tracks. They were sketched and they were photographed. Mr. Taylor's heavy duty work trousers were sent for forensic examination by the police, and they said that there was two tears on either side, went right through them. That was consistent with being pulled upwards. And again, we have part of the police forensic report reproduced in the book. Some years after the encounter, I had the pleasure of speaking to Mr. Taylor. He was now living in retirement, and that was I was with my colleague Malcolm Robinson, who had arranged the interview, and he stuck to his story, and that's like no other account. You've never seen these strange things. I'm not aware of a forensic investigation by the police anywhere else, certainly not in the UK anyway. And when Malcolm and I went back to the location, the local forestry commission or the council, and I put in a picnic bench where it was. This is just a little aside issue, Simon. And just off the cuff, I said to Malcolm, why don't you get a little brass plaque made and just screw it onto the side of the picnic bench, you know, Robert Taylor Livingston, whatever. So Malcolm took that idea and he ran with it, did a great job. And he took it up with the local council. He eventually put up a huge, great stone cairn with a plaque on it. And in recent years, they've also put up signage, in the area. And again, that's all the whole down to Malcolm Robinson. Malcolm has written the definitive book on the Livingston case. I can't remember what it's called, even though I have read it. But that's sort of one of the only well-known cases that I've put in the book. Simply because I'd had the opportunity to go and speak to Mr. Taylor, you know, in person. And again, it's a fascinating event. Here we have a full forensic police investigation and they couldn't figure out what it was, Simon.
But there's a case in Aylesbury, 1946, which I thought was pretty weird. One of the occupants of the craft said, how did he get here? His clothes are at least 100 years old.
Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire. Now, yeah, a man walking along a country road sighted a huge dome-shaped structure on a field across from him. As he watched, several glass-like doors seemed to open and shut. The witness approached the object and saw several men in silvery suits, apparently working around the object. One saw him and was heard to say, how did he get here? His clothes look at least 100 years old. Two of the men then seized him and dragged him inside the object. He managed to break away and ran through some of the doors. He ran for a while, turned around, and the craft had disappeared. Well, yeah. Now, you know, all of us at some point will have discussed what we believe UFO phenomena is, what's the nature and origin of it. The most popular theory, as we would say, and the most romantic as well, we might add, is that there are beings from another world. You know, this is the extraterrestrial hypothesis. However, in recent years, other ideas have grown in popularity, should we say, Simon. One of those is that, you know, this phenomenon is us, but from the future. So the aliens that people claim to have seen are not alien at all. They're just us as we have evolved at some point in the future. For example, Jim Penniston is one of the main witnesses to the Rendlesham Forest events that took place in the UK in December 1980. Everybody will know the case. I'm not going to in any great detail. It is not featured in my book. But Jim Penniston claims he, in the forest that night, he encountered this triangular-shaped object with red lights on top, blue lights underneath. It was warm to touch. It was smooth. It had these symbols on the side. And he downloaded some kind of binary system into him. But what Jim claims is that this thing is not alien that he touched. It is us from the future. It was a time machine. So then you look back at this little case, because it is only a brief paragraph that I've dug out. And it says, you know, look at him. His clothes must be at least 100 years old. As if they're from our future. So it's an interesting little parallel.
We've been talking about the book, UFO Landings UK, and that's out on Amazon and people can get it all around the world, can't they?
Yeah, anywhere in the world you can log into Amazon. It's out as a softback, a hardback and a Kindle, and the audio book should be with us quite soon. And I hope you enjoy it. I really do.
And that's on Flying Disc Press, which is a press that you run, and you have lots of books of all about UFOs.
Yeah, I started my own publishing concern in 2015 called Flying Disc Press. That's disc with a K. So if you want to find out about what else we have on offer, just punch in flyingdiscpress.com. You'll find me. And I'm on Facebook as well and Twitter. So I'm very easy to find, Simon.
Great. Well, thanks again for coming back to the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
My pleasure, Simon. And I'm sure we'll speak again at some point.
Yeah. And that was an interview with Philip Mantle about his book, UFO Landings in UK. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour and 16 minutes. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, where you can find my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast. There are over 200 episodes, and it's where I look into evidence of the afterlife. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And on Twitter, I am at Simon G. Bown. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.